This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are two reporters who have been covering the story of the leak that Joseph Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame Wilson, was a CIA undercover operative. The leak is being investigated by Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald and a grand jury. My guests are Adam Liptak, national legal correspondent for the New York Times, and Anne-Marie Squeo, a staff reporter covering the Justice Department for the Wall Street Journal. It was 2 years ago that former Ambassador Joseph Wilson wrote an op-ed for the New York Times saying that when he was sent to Africa by the CIA in 2002, he found no evidence supporting the claim that Iraq was trying to acquire nuclear materials in Niger. He suggested that some of the intelligence related to Iraq's nuclear weapons program was twisted to exaggerate the Iraqi threat. A week after the op-ed, conservative columnist Robert Novak published a piece saying that senior administration confidential sources told him that Wilson's trip to Africa was suggested by his wife, who was a CIA operative. Wilson says his wife was outed to punish and discredit him. Novak has testified before the grand jury, but declined to publicly discuss his role. Yesterday, Robert Novak broke his silence on his involvement in the story. What did his article tell us that we didn't already know? Anne-Marie, you want to start?
Sure. I don't think it told us anything that we didn't already know. He has written a column before, one column between the original column that disclosed Valerie Plame's name and now. It was in October of 2003. And he seemed to repeat some stuff that he had already said in October of 2003. So I don't think there was much new stuff in there. I mean, Novak has now twice made reference to who's who in America and former diplomat Joseph Wilson's listing there and how it mentions his wife's name. And he may or may not be trying to signal something, but
the larger problem with Novak is that we're now in a situation where four different reporters have testified. All of them have more or less laid out what they've talked about. One reporter, Judith Miller of the New York Times, is in jail now, coming up on a month. And yet Robert Novak, although he's free to talk about what he may have said to the grand jury, if indeed he testified, just won't lay out the facts. And that lack of transparency and is a kind of violation, I think, of the bond that journalists have with their readers, to not to say who his source was, no one's suggesting that, but that he should say what he has done or not done in cooperating with the special prosecutor in the case, Patrick J. Fitzgerald.
One of the things that Novak did say in his column is that Bill Harlow, the CIA spokesperson who warned him twice not to publish the name of Valerie Wilson or Valerie Plame, Novak says Harlow never said that she was undercover or that her disclosure would endanger her or anybody else. And had he said that, Novak said, I wouldn't have printed it. Harlow says he couldn't reveal her identity as a covert officer because it's classified. He'd be violating the law if he revealed that. So, Adam Liptak, how do you interpret that those two different versions of the story?
He has, from time to time, in very cryptic ways, in his columns, alluded to what he was told, and his line is sort of that. Yes, the CIA asked them not to publish, but they didn't ask very hard. It was a sort of soft request, and had they asked better, he would not have published her identity. And somehow this latest comment got him worked up, and he came back to the subject. But he concedes that he was told by the CIA that they would like him not to publish her identity. And why else would the CIA ask but that it would compromise some aspect of their operations?
Just one point to add. It's sort of an interesting thing. I haven't covered intelligence per se in my career, but in talking to my colleagues who have, you just don't publish CIA agents' names without really good reason. I mean, it's fine to publish the director or the deputy director or some like high-ranking official who's in the public sphere. But the average CIA agent isn't named because often you can't know if they're undercover or not. And it's always been very widely accepted by reporters that they just don't publish CIA agents' names willy-nilly. And he appears to have done that in this case.
Novak is clearly not a fan of Joseph Wilson and doesn't think of Wilson as being very credible. He says in his column, yesterday. Wilson was discarded a year ago by the Kerry presidential campaign after the Senate committee reported that much of what he said had no basis in fact. Covering the story, do you think that Joseph Wilson's credibility has been factually undermined? I know people have been trying to undermine his credibility, but is there any evidence that he actually really is not credible as a source about Saddam Hussein and attempts to sell, to buy yellow cake in Niger?
I mean, certainly there are people who are less credible who have put themselves out there as experts on Saddam Hussein and Niger. I mean, I think that what's interesting about that original Bob Novak column is it actually isn't that critical of Joe Wilson. This seems to be a relatively new thing he's gotten into. But the man did have a resume that would make him an obvious candidate for this. He probably didn't do himself any favors by joining the Kerry campaign, which, you know, could give this whole situation an air of partisanship. But, you know, he went there, which is more than a lot of other people did at the time, and he spent 10 days there or 8 days there, and he talked to a lot of people, and he came away convinced that this thing hadn't happened. And certainly the administration has since agreed that, you know, that was something that probably they shouldn't have included in the State of the Union address.
I think you got to separate out two issues. One is that at least in a detail, but probably an important detail, Wilson may have overstated the situation. He fairly categorically said that his wife had nothing to do with sending him to Niger. Most people now agree, and a Senate committee has found, that she at least suggested his name. She didn't send him. She wouldn't have the power to send him. She didn't authorize sending him. But she did have a role in sending him to Niger. And I guess that goes to the question of whether he was there in some sense in a nepotistic way, in a way that undermines his seriousness of his mission. I'm not sure I buy that, but it is a topic that's at least worthy of discussion. And Novak would say that that's the topic that his initial column discussed. On the other hand, it's largely a separate issue from whether someone, it's entirely a separate issue from whether someone should violate the law for political ends in disclosing the identity of a CIA agent, whatever the motivation.
Now, you could argue that it's in the best interests of President Bush and the White House to downplay this whole story of the CIA leak, to downplay it as much as possible, because, you know, let's face it, people in the Bush administration are implicated in this. You know, Karl Rove, Louis Libby, did they help leak the name, or did they leak the identity of a covert agent? You could also argue it's in the best interests of Bush's opponents to keep this story going, because it might finally discredit people in the Bush White House. Are you getting a lot of sources who are trying to spin the story for you now? And are you actually getting leaks from each side trying to spin the story? Adam?
Well, it's a funny thing, because even as this case supposedly is drying up confidential sources all over town, in this very case, people are leaking like crazy. And of course they leak for partisan ends, but that's not unusual in the world of leaking. People generally have an agenda, and it's the job of the journalist to try to filter out the facts from the agenda. Is this good for Democrats, bad for Republicans? Seemingly so. And that does, of course, color the way people talk to you. It's very hard. Grand juries are secret, meant to be secret, and perhaps Anne Marie has better luck than me, but Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor, has run an exceedingly tight ship.
Would you talk a little bit more about the difficulty of covering a story that's involved with a grand jury investigation when the special prosecutor has urged everybody who testified not to talk about their testimony?
I mean, you know, as Adam just said, grand juries are meant to be secret because, you know, at the end of the day, most often they end up indicting people, but they also don't at times based on the evidence that they've seen. And in this case has gone on, I guess this grand jury was impaneled in January of 2004. So they've been at this for a while. And I mean, they've had some big lulls as a result of the appellate process for the media subpoenas and stuff. But I mean, they've gotten a lot of information, and no one covering this story has I mean, I wouldn't put myself out there, has any idea whether there will be any indictments. I mean, it's just, it's that secretive. And that's what actually makes this quite hard, because when you get drips and drabs from one side's attorney or some other folks, and you really don't know how they know this except through their client. And obviously, if you're a good prosecutor, you're asking questions that, you know, may or may not be giving the witness any sign of where you're going. At the end of the day, the witness walks out of the room not knowing what you were thinking. So, I mean, Karl Rove can sit there and testify, and he can leave the room, and he's obviously a very brilliant man, but he may have no idea what Pat Fitzgerald was really after and what question was sort of the most crucial one to him. That said, Karl Rove has been called back to testify 3 times, which even his own defense attorney would admit is not normal. I mean, that's a fairly aggressive callback.
Let's sum up a little bit of what we know so far in this investigation and what we know of different people's involvement. Let's start with Karl Rove. Adam Liptak, what do we know so far about Karl Rove's involvement?
The only thing we know for sure is that he talked to Matt Cooper and that he talked to Robert Novak, and that in each case, while not using the name of Valerie Plame or Valerie Wilson, which is the name she actually goes by, he at a minimum confirmed that her identity as a CIA operative. And whether that was benign or not, whether that violated or not the 1982 law that's at the root of this investigation, which makes it, it's fairly hard to violate, but it's a serious criminal statute. It makes it a crime to intentionally, knowingly disclose the identity of an undercover agent who has been in the field in the past 5 years and whose identity you know the government is trying to keep secret. That requires quite a lot of knowledge, actually. And one thing we're hearing from Rove's camp is that Rove contends that he heard this information directly or secondhand from journalists, which would suggest that he didn't have the kind of knowledge that's required to violate the law.
What do we know about Louis Libby's involvement? Louis Libby is the chief of staff for Vice President Dick Cheney.
Well, and I mean, in that case, we seem to know that he spoke to Matthew Cooper because Cooper has testified about that conversation. But and also, I believe, Adam, correct me if I'm wrong, but Libby also has said he thinks he heard about it from a journalist about
right.
Miss Wilson's identity. So the interesting element of the journalist defense, which is an interesting one for this administration, is if these guys also knew this, if they also at the same time had, say, this State Department memo that everyone has been focused on, which makes clear that her identity is secret and that she is a CIA operative, if they also had access to that and saw that and knew independently that her identity was classified, and even though they heard it from a journalist, they still broke a separate law, a federal criminal law for releasing classified information or confirming even classified information. So the 1982 law is, as Adam said, very narrow. And it was written specifically to address the Philip Agee situation, where he had a list of CIA agents that he disclosed maliciously, intending to hurt the United States and the potential welfare of these agents. And that's a hard bar to get over. But there are federal criminal statutes that require those with access to classified information not to release it and not to confirm it. Now, of course, that's difficult because in this town, classified information is released every single day by accident and on purpose. But that's certainly available to the special prosecutor if he wants to go ahead and make charges in this case, if he decides that, well, it didn't meet the 1982 statute's requirements, but in fact, they have violated this other aspect of the law.
Let's look at the State Department memo that was circulated just before Robert Novak's column was published. It was written to then Secretary of State Powell. He has known to have had it on Air Force One. What is the importance of this State Department memo?
Well, it goes back to Anne-Marie's point that to the extent administration officials who may have shared Valerie Plame's identity with journalists knew it from a classified source like that memo, they may well be in trouble under the 1982 law. So what Fitzgerald seems to be doing is trying to nail down what their source of information was, because he does need to show that they learned it from classified sources, and then or at least knew it from classified sources at a time when they may also have been hearing it elsewhere.
Alberto Gonzalez, who is now Attorney General and in 2003 was White House counsel, was told at 8:30 in the evening on September 29, 2003, that there was going to be an investigation into this CIA leak. But it wasn't until the following morning, about 12 hours later, that he informed the White House that it had to preserve all materials relevant to the investigation. There is one person he told the evening that he was notified, and that was the White House Chief of Staff. Adam Liptak, what questions does this raise?
I have seen no indication. I mean, obviously, it would have been better to do everything immediately. But I've seen no indication that, and there's been no allegation, that in the meantime anyone was destroying evidence, that the White House acted in an access to all sorts of things that have allowed him to pinpoint particular conversations between particular officials and particular journalists. So I suppose it would have been better if the email saying preserve all documents went out the moment Gonzalez knew. But in the real world, a 12-hour gap is not the most unusual thing.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's a little bit of a red herring that folks have latched onto. I mean, perhaps they did try to destroy a lot of documents, but as we all know, you know, it's kind of hard to destroy phone records, and emails have a shelf life, you know, longer than a human one these days.
What do you think is the larger significance of the story, the larger questions that this story raises? I know that we're still in the question phase because we don't have a lot of information. But knowing what you know now, what is this story really about? What is the larger story about? Adam?
You know, I can't help but be fascinated by the press angle here. The Wall Street Journal, and Anne-Marie was one of the reporters on the story, had a really good story last week about how Time magazine and the New York Times took quite different positions in the end about the level of about how they and their reporters should cooperate in this investigation. And I think one of the many things that this case has exposed is a sort of fault line between different kinds of media companies.
Anne-Marie, in the article you co-wrote in the Wall Street Journal about why Matt Cooper and Time ended up getting a different lawyer from the lawyer they originally started out with, because they and Judith Miller were originally represented by the same lawyer.
Right.
You write about how Matt Cooper and Time felt that their interests were diverging from Judith Miller's. In what ways?
Well, I think there were two issues for Matt Cooper. I mean, one was that he had agreed at one point in 2004 to testify over his conversation with Scooter Libby after he got permission from Mr. Libby to do that. So, and Judith was at the time fairly public in saying that she didn't believe that these waivers that the special prosecutor had obtained from administration officials were sort of valid. They were requirements. They had to sign them. And therefore, you know, they were kind of coerced. And so there was already some friction there. I mean, Cooper has decided that his waiver plus some express permission from Libby has allowed him to testify. Miller is out publicly saying she thinks these waivers are coerced. So there was that. And then there is this sort of interesting separate thing between Miller and the special prosecutor, because they've got a separate case going on involving an Islamic charity that may or may not have been involved in terrorist financing. And Patrick Fitzgerald, in that case, has tried to obtain Judith Miller's phone records in order to prove that the New York Times story about this charity may have tipped them off to the fact that the FBI was going to raid them. And a judge in New York denied his request. So there is this tension point between Miller and Fitzgerald. Now, I mean, I don't know if that affects his thinking in any way, shape, or form, but, I mean, it was a difference, again, another difference between Cooper's situation and Miller's situation.
In describing, you know, Cooper and Miller, Cooper, like Miller, didn't think that a blanket waiver was a serious waiver. The difference is that Cooper's lawyer, I think, asked for and ended up getting a personal waiver. I'm not sure that Judith Miller ever asked for the personal waiver. She might have accepted it had it been offered, but I don't know that she actually asked for it.
Let me first say that I'm here as a reporter. I don't speak for Judy. I don't speak for the Times. But I can say that Judy and her lawyers have declined to answer the question of whether they have done anything at all to contact the source and try to obtain a satisfactory waiver.
Well, certainly, I mean, as a bunch of journalists who love to study themselves, I mean, I think the media stuff is interesting. But I also think, as somebody who's spent a lot of time in this profession in Washington, that it kind of reveals this in a way that we don't always see every day, this dark underbelly of how the spin machine works, especially in a White House under siege over a war in Iraq. And, you know, these are not things that we're, you know, we're sort of privy to it ad hoc, depending upon your own personal conversations with various people. But this whole investigation has sort of exposed, you know, in a very public way, the kinds of lengths that the administration, any administration probably, goes to protect the boss and make him, you know, try to discredit the folks who are delivering the bad news.
Well, and to put the worst spin on it, and it's not clear what the right spin is, but to put the worst spin on it, the administration may have endangered a CIA operative, or if not her, the sources she dealt with while undercover abroad, in order to gain political advantage in connection with a very controversial war.
And a short-term political advantage, I think, is sort of the key. I mean, this is a long-term impact on her and anybody she may have had dealings with overseas, but a short-term impact, because the Joseph Wilson thing, you know, would probably have hit for about a week or two, and then it would have been upstaged by some other event that had happened, probably also related to the war, but not about Joseph Wilson anymore. So, I mean, this was a fairly aggressive attack on something that may or may not have dissipated, you know, with the apology they ended up giving for the State of the Union, had they not gone on the spin machine, it turned on the spin machine full blast, perhaps it would have gone away.
Do you both agree that the story is not just about the leak of a CIA operative's name, but it's about White House efforts to discredit information that contradicted their point of view?
That's essentially what Patrick Fitzgerald says in his papers. So that's, you know, that's the raison d'etre of the investigation, that this was a calculated attempt to silence or punish an administration critic exercising his First Amendment rights. And I paraphrase, but only a little bit, from what the special prosecutor has put in his court papers. So that is not, you know, a pundit's opinion, but the opinion of the person conducting the investigation.
The New York Times is part of this story. Judith Miller of the New York Times is in prison because she will not reveal the name of her confidential source or sources. So is the fact that the New York Times is such a part of the story affecting the kinds of resources the paper is putting behind investigating the story?
I think the answer to that is no. I think Anne Marie's right that this is a big story regardless. If anything, on the Judy Miller aspect of it, our executive editor, Bill Keller, has been quoted saying that he doesn't want to see sort of jailhouse interviews with Judy and how's Judy doing kinds of stories that might elicit sympathy for her, because that would amount to a sort of special pleading. And I think the paper is trying to do its level best to make a news judgment unaffected by the fact that it's a player in the case. At the end of the day, it's for others to judge about whether those judgments are being correctly made. But I have the feeling that we are doing what we can to neither come at it too hard or too soft. And I do know that in the relatively difficult position of covering a story involving a colleague and my own paper, that I've never had the sense of being guided in one direction or another other than to write it as straight as I can.
Have either of you broken new parts of the story? And would you describe what that part was and how it furthered the story?
Well, I mean, last week, I think it was last week, it's all kind of gelling together. I mean, we broke a story on this State Department memo and how the part of it that talks about Valerie Wilson and her role in her husband's trip to Niger was marked at the beginning secret, not foreign, which basically means that, you know, in the world of classified information, top secret is above that. And this is obviously information that the government knew was not supposed to get out. We then further found out that the entire memo was stamped top secret, which would have given anybody who saw it a clue that they shouldn't have been discussing it very widely. So, I mean, that was one of the interesting stories that we just found out about.
So the implication is anybody who got the information from this State Department memo
would have known they should not be talking about it.
Right, and it would be more likely than that they could actually be charged with breaking the law that forbids you from revealing the identity of an undercover agent.
Possibly not that law, but a law that says that you're not supposed to be disclosing or confirming classified information. Mm-hmm. I mean, remember, that law is so narrow that, I mean, I'm not sure any prosecutor wants to bring a case under that unless he really has a ton of evidence to support it.
And Emery, did you co-write this story?
Yes.
Yes. And what could you tell us about how you got access to the memo?
Well, you know, in this case, we talked to people who had the memo. You know, it wasn't that I necessarily had it, but just that we talked to, you know, as we were saying earlier, I mean, this is one of those stories where you're trying to figure out every day who else might have a piece of information that I haven't talked to yet and talk to them, as many people as possible, because we are in this vacuum. The special prosecutor is not telling us anything, not that he should be necessarily, but, you know, grand jury proceedings are secret. There is this appetite to try to figure out what Pat Fitzgerald is trying to figure out. So we're all trying to act as if we're, you know, our own special prosecutors. But, I mean, I think there's a momentum here, and all the news organizations are trying to do smart analysis, find out information that may or may not be shedding light on the investigation, and figure out where this is going.
And on Liptak, parts of the story that you broke?
Well, I think the Times was the first paper to establish that Karl Rove was Matt Cooper's source, and that that seemed to move the story forward significantly. We had that in a story on the day that that Judy Miller was jailed, and it got a little lost in there. but it was nonetheless a real turning point in the case.
And mm-hmm. Did you co-write that article?
Yes.
Is there anything else you could say about how you got the information?
I think I shouldn't.
Right. Okay. There are very spirited editorial pages at each of your papers, and I know reporters are separate from the editorial pages of newspapers, but I want to ask you about the editorial position on the story at each of your papers and how, if at all, it's affecting the reporters covering the story. Emery, let me start with you. At the Wall Street Journal,
oh, great.
At the Wall Street Journal on July 13th, there was an editorial that read, "We'd say the White House political guru Karl Rove deserves a prize. For Mr. Rove is turning out to be the real whistleblower in this whole pseudo-scandal. He's the one who warned Times' Matthew Cooper and other reporters to be wary of Mr. Wilson's credibility. He's the one who told the press the truth that Mr. Wilson had been recommended for the CIA consulting gig by his wife, not by Vice President Dick Cheney, as Mr. Wilson was asserting on the airwaves. In short, Mr. Rove provided important background so Americans could understand that Mr. Wilson wasn't a whistleblower, but was a partisan trying to discredit the Iraq war in an election campaign. Thank you, Mr. Rove." Emery, how did that editorial play among the reporters who are out there covering the story and consider this investigation to be a very grave one?
Can I say no comment?
You can say whatever you want.
I mean, you know, I make no defense of opinions that are stated in our editorial page. I mean, they obviously, they approach a lot of different topics in ways that are frequently at odds with the reporters who are covering the story. But, I mean, there's a world of difference between our mission statements as news reporters and editorial writers. And, You know, I think it's an important story. And, I, you know, maybe Karl Rove should get a prize at the end of the day, but I don't think we know that by any of the information that we have now. And I certainly would never feel comfortable stating something like that.
Adam Liptak, the New York Times has, on the whole, been very critical of the Bush White House and obviously, you know, supports Judith Miller's position in not revealing her source. Have those have the New York Times editorials affected the reporters covering the story or affected your ability to get sources to talk with you?
No, I think. If there's something to be said about the New York Times editorial page is that, and the Wall Street Journal has criticized it on these very grounds, it did call quite stridently for the special prosecutor to investigate the leak and might have done a better job looking over the horizon a little bit about where that might lead, which is to say to our very own doorstep. So there is, shall we say, an irony to that. The editorial page's positions do not affect our news coverage, and I read them with interest and amusement as I read the Wall Street Journal's editorials with interest and amusement. We're in the business of trying to nail down facts.
Have your papers changed their policies on leaks and on how to refer to leaked information in articles? Adam?
Well, over the past couple years, we have become much more sensitive to trying to minimize the number of confidential sources used in our reporting, and when we do, to try to explain as best we can and be as straight with the reader as we can in saying who these people are, why they're in a position to know, and what their biases might be. And I think we still have a long way to go on that. Looking forward, I think our paper is more geared to trying to figure out ways to protect our sources better, to make sure that we don't find ourselves in the position that Time did when it felt compelled to turn over emails disclosing the names of confidential sources, to make sure that we don't have phone records in the hands of third-party providers or travel records in the hands of travel agents or anything else that might disclose confidential sources that prosecutors and litigants and others can get their hands on. So we're taking a very hard look at that. I think in other papers, the LA Times, I feel like I read the Wall Street Journal's general counsel, Stuart Carl, speaking to this too, that people are wondering about what sort of deal a reporter on his or her own is authorized to make with a source. Are mm-hmm. they allowed to make "I promise to go to jail" deals with their sources, knowing that their company will stand behind them if they do? My impression at the New York Times is that that is, was, is, and will continue to be a deal that I'm authorized to make and that I believe I will uphold. I'm not sure if I were a source talking to Time magazine, I'd be all that comfortable knowing that they would protect me to the very end.
Do you tell sources that you're willing to go to jail to protect their identity?
If they ask.
Right.
And if it's the appropriate case, which is not always the case. But in the appropriate case, lots and lots of important information that bears on the conduct of government and powerful institutions can only be gotten by promising people who would be their jobs, and in the case of Valerie Plame, some people say their lives, could be endangered, except if people manage to keep secrets. And those secrets have been the basis for Watergate, for the Pentagon Papers, for countless incredibly important stories.
Anne-Marie, has the policy changed at the Wall Street Journal for taking information from confidential sources or just describing that information in the paper?
No, the policy hasn't changed at all. The journal has always been kind of very rigorous in doing these seminars with reporters about these kinds of arrangements, what it means, and certainly that's going on now because our general counsel, Stuart Carl, who Adam just mentioned, I mean, he is going around to some of the bureaus, especially he came to Washington last week, and we had an hour sit down with him and asked him questions. And the biggest concern, I think Adam rightly stated, for us is how to make sure that if we're confronted with the same situation, the Wall Street Journal isn't, you know, in some weird position where they're going to be Dow Jones and Company, our parent corporation is going to be fined every day because they're in possession of some notebooks. So, I mean, the thing that most of the media outlets and certainly most of the reporters I've spoken to are worried about and are actively addressing is how do we take our notes? How do we do our jobs in a way that protects both our sources and ourselves from a subpoena?
One of the interesting things here is in some ways you might have to rely more on memory if you don't want there to be a kind of paper trail for confidential sources. And it puts you almost in the position of being like a spy who has to, like, eat the document afterwards so that there's no evidence. And, I mean, one of the important things about reporting is having notes to refer back to so that you can check yourself, so that you have not just memory, which is faulty, but that you have papers, you have evidence of what somebody said. So is it difficult to do your job and not leave a paper trail?
Well, I think it is. But I think, you know, some of the things, Adam, I'll let you go. I just want to make one point. I mean, you know, Matt Cooper's email to his boss didn't have to take place. He could have gotten up and gone down the hall and talked to him or called him on the phone. I mean, there are ways that we can try to narrow the possibilities, right? I mean, and we've all gotten so reliant on email and cell phones. If cell phone records are so easy to get, you know, that we don't think about it anymore. But, you know, it used to be, I mean, and it was a little before my time, but reporters routinely used payphones to call their sources. And, you know, I had a colleague who used to mail prepaid phone cards to his sources and tell them only to call them on that. And we used to joke that he was paranoid, but apparently he had the right idea. Because, I mean, there are little ways we can do this. I mean, it is impossible not to write stuff down, I think, especially when you're dealing with elaborate stories. But there are little things you can do that would make a big difference.
If given your druthers, would you cover the story through to the end yourselves? I mean, do you want to stay on it?
Yes.
Yeah. Adam, why do you feel so strongly about it?
Oh, as we've sort of explored in the past hour, it's got so many great strands to it. It's just fascinating. It's authentically important. It implicates justice, intelligence, foreign policy, the role of the press. It's a terrific, fascinating story, and I only wish it were a little less tangled, because I have the feeling that sometimes readers get lost when you try to explain, as we have to over paragraph after paragraph, the tangled background of the story. But the patient reader who, you know, is willing to absorb and take it all in will find that it's a very illuminating, interesting story.
Emery?
Yeah, absolutely. And just not, you know, to echo what Adam has said, I mean, I think that as a reporter, these are the kinds of stories you want to cover. You know, it's kind of invigorating, and every morning you pick up your rival's newspapers with dread and anticipation that they may have scooped you, or, you know, or really excited because you might have scooped them. And I mean, I think it's, you know, if you're a reporter, this is a hot story. There's a lot of very interesting aspects to it, and, you know, there's still so much intrigue about it that we have yet to find out, and that was one of the interesting points I wanted to make to you. I mean, we don't know if we'll ever find out what has happened in the last 2 years, because at the end of the day, if the special prosecutor decides not to bring charges against anyone because he's not an independent counsel under the old independent counsel law, he has no responsibility to issue a report to tell us what we've all been chasing for 2 years and why he made the decision that he made. So, I mean, you know, we're all sort of, you know, it's kind of like a cliffhanger, and we're really trying to put together where the story is going without having any idea whether we'll ever know where the story went.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having us.
Adam Liptak is national legal correspondent for the New York Times. Anne-Marie Squeo covers the Justice Department and law enforcement for the Wall Street Journal. Our interview was recorded this morning. You can see a timeline of the CIA leak case on our website, freshair.npr.org.